Hey folks, Damian Mason coming at you. Before we hop into another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture, I want to tell you about Pattern Ag. Pattern Ag is a company that has pioneered predictive soil analytics. You know, we always treated diseases and pests after they were already in the field, when they were already causing us a problem. But what if you can do this proactively through predictive soil analytics? Pattern has a technology that through their technology, you can say, oh, here's the likelihood that I'm going to have soybean cyst nematode. Here is the prediction on how bad of a risk I face for sudden death syndrome or corn rootworm and a whole bunch of other diseases and pests. When you know what your risk factor is, you can more efficiently and proactively treat for the disease. You can do this by going to pattern.ag and figuring out what your risk factors are through predictive analytics. That's right. Go to www.pattern.ag and then get a hold of your Pattern Ag representative to help you do predictive analytics on your farming operation. Well, greetings and welcome to another fantastic episode of the Business of Agriculture podcast. If you are watching this, you can see that this is really out of the ballpark production. That's right. I am sitting here at a panel and I'm with some people that are going to share the future of agriculture from the lens and the perspective of machinery. I've got the CEO of AgriVision and Prairie Land Partners, John Deere dealerships between Iowa and Kansas. I've also got the director of sales, that's John Carlo, for that company. And I've got a representative from John Deere. We're talking about the perspective from their viewpoint on the business of agriculture, the future, technology, and also how it ties into machinery. We're talking about capitalization. We're talking about consolidation of the farm base. We're talking about where this whole thing is going to go. We've got a lot to cover. We'll get right to it. Okay, Jeremy Ostrander, CEO of these two dealerships. You work in Western Iowa and East Central Kansas. You're a farm guy.
I do. I plant some corn and soybeans, got a few cows.
All right. And you were worried before we started. You want to make sure that these people didn't think you were just some, you know, corporate type. And you said, you know, I also, you know, I rope cattle. Go ahead and show us right now for those who are watching.
Okay. I'm not very good at it.
All right. He's missing, if you're listening, he's missing his ring finger on his right hand because, you know, he wanted to prove that he can still get out there and rope like a cowboy. And he can. But you know what? There's going to be some appendages missing. John Carlo, you are the person that got a hold of me about this this coming and speaking at your event. 32 dealerships between two states. Tell me about what happens there between those two states and what your role is. Because you were an Air Force guy, raised on a farm, came to this industry.
Absolutely. So today, with 32 stores, Damien, it's obviously a huge geography, right? A huge variety of crops, of customer mix, a variety of scales. But I think the key part for my role is how do we connect with those customers and how do we help them see what the future looks like in agriculture? Because if we just wait for them to come to us, we're afraid that we'll be in the back seat, and that's not a position we're going to be in.
Yeah, we're going to definitely get into that, how the dealership arrangement is changing and how we really are seeing a vast amount of change in a short order at the dealership level and also what the customer does, sees, how they interact, etc. Dan Paschke, you are the division business manager for John Deere. You oversee four states, 19 different dealership units, yes?
That's right. Right. Yep, I work across the states of Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, and Colorado. So I get to lead the field team that works and interacts with our dealers across those states on a daily basis. So we work together to make sure we're taking care of customers.
What I think is really cool is that you also worked in China for a few years, so we got a lot of perspective there. The reason, dear listener, that we're doing this also is I spoke to this group, but we spent the entire day yesterday out in the field at a thing called their training center, the John Deere Training Center here just east of Orlando. And we're going to talk about some of the cool technology we saw there and what might be coming to a farm near you. Let's start off talking about technology. I got a buddy who I went to college with, works in Silicon Valley, and he said, Damien, he said, this smartphone that's in your hand right here has more technology than the Apollo program 50 years ago that NASA was sending out to outer space. That's pretty mind-boggling when you think about it. A NASA program 50 years ago, and you've got more technology and, frankly, userability right here in your hand. We're seeing that with machinery. Talk to me.
Yeah, it's unbelievable the amount of technology that is getting packed into all the different pieces of equipment that we're using in modern farm operations. When you think about the amount of sensors, the amount of data that's being taken, every pass through the field, we're collecting data. So when the farmer is running a tillage tool through, we're collecting data and understanding exactly what they're doing. When they're going to plant, we know where those seeds are going. We know exactly how to space them properly, and we know how to relay that back through a cloud service we call the operations center. When we go through and spray, we're taking data. And when we get to the harvest at the end of the year, we're collecting data again to be able to compare the different steps in the process. And the amount of technology it takes to do that, it is really mind-blowing. So we've got GPS receivers, we've got displays in the cabs, all kinds of technology today that really helps a farmer be more efficient and produce higher yields.
All right, so Giancarlo, I do a lot of work with Extreme Ag. They are progressive, forward-thinking, larger-scale farmers in the United States. I produce content and podcasts for them called Cutting the Curve. One of the guys is Matt Miles down in Arkansas, 12,000-acre operator, bought into the whole John Deere thing. He's, I think, one of your, I think you call it the MUD multi-unit buyers. And he said something smart when I talked to him. He said, you know what? In the old days, we want to make sure that the harvest got done. And if that technology wasn't working, we didn't care. Get the crop harvested. Mm-hmm. He said, now, if the technology is not gleaning all of the, in addition to gleaning the crop, if we're not gleaning the yield and then all the other information that this combine can harvest, we will not do the harvest until that is working, because I want to know what that is bringing in. What are we bringing in when that, besides the soybeans, besides the rice, besides the corn, when we go across that field, what are we bringing in that he was so concerned about in terms of the data?
Well, I think, and let's back up just a little bit, because I think when you think about technology, when it first came out, AutoTrack, right? And when AutoTrack came out, we were still putting markers on planters. And the just in case, right?
Auto just track,
in
case. Just for the listener.
Auto steer.
Okay.
Yeah. Auto steer.
Remember, I've got people that are not machinery people, sure. So always remember that you know more. So auto track means auto steer.
Don't have to put your hands on the wheel.
Okay.
And it will go. It'll run in a straight line. It'll run on a curve without touching the steering
wheel. And what's remarkable is we're talking about now Google cars that are going to drive themselves. We were doing this in farm machinery how many years ago?
2002, we introduced AutoTrack.
20 years we've been having tractors that drive themselves, and they're still not quite there on Google cars.
Absolutely, absolutely. So then, over time, as the confidence grew in the technology, like AutoTrack, we started selling planters without markers because they believed in it. But what happens, to your point, is if the auto steer has an issue or there's something going on, we typically get a call, and it's like, I've got to stop doing what I'm doing to make sure that I can auto track.
Okay.
And even if you could still drive the line, right? There's a lot of pride in farmers being able to drive. But then fast forward to today.
Straight rows.
Absolutely.
Remember, there was a time in the 70s, and some of us are old enough to remember this, and your old man and the family left church and went and drove around and to check the crops. And what check the crops really meant was you're driving around judging the neighbor's crops. And if their rows weren't straight, that meant that they didn't know what the hell they were doing.
Absolutely. So then that was more of the operational side. Well, now if you fast forward, if we aren't collecting data, because our producers are wanting to see that if they did this for preparation or tillage, and then they planted this variety at this time, and they sprayed this chemistry at this time, the outcome is so important that they need to know exactly what that outcome was, because they want to either replicate it, modify it, or do something completely different. But if you don't have that yield data, you're really naked in the wind.
Okay, so it's not just yield data. Also, there's that's what I'm saying about the stuff that we're gathering. We go across that field. There's obviously the yield monitor. We've been doing that for a long time. But what else? I'm seeing some other stuff as it relates to this, the field map. And you showed me something. We'll get to the planting map. What are we seeing there, Jeremy?
You know, one of the interesting things is this: that we're on a journey, and it's building blocks. So a lot of people don't realize we're taking the data off of the planter pass, and we're optimizing the sprayer pass. And the sprayer pass then feeds onto the nutrient pass, and it's just building blocks every step of the way. I mean, we can use the height off of a planter, the geography that it's the terrain, to feed the combine, so the combine's optimized in the way the head performs and those kind of things.
Yeah, I think it's kind of cool what you just said there, that the data from the combine at fall, at harvest, is then overlaid with what we did with the sprayer with three passes during the season, let's say, which is overlaid with what happened in the tractor with the planter that you did in March, April, May, whatever, depending on where you are geographically. And all of a sudden, we've got a real good snapshot of what's happening there.
You know, one that we do on our farm, we want to plant back over the top of the nutrients, which is going to reduce the nutrient needs that we have. But that means when we run anhydrous here in 2 or 3 weeks, like, we have to be prepared. Everything's got to be in it, ready to go in the display. And, you know, you take different operators from 25 to 75. There's a little prep that goes in ahead of time.
I want to talk about user ability, but before I get to that, there's a bunch of data. We talked about that. This is way more than just horsepower. You know, the John Deere 4020 was revolutionary, and God knows the farm people of today still just can't get enough John Deere 4020, 4020 anyway. But you know what? It was advanced technology for its time, but it wasn't collecting data. I think John Deere is just spying on me. I think you're just taking all this data so you know and can control me.
No.
Now, I've heard this, no, and you've heard this. Have we heard this?
Take your tinfoil hat off.
All right, so
you're doing
this just so that I end up working for you. Prove me wrong, Dan.
No. Yeah, no. One of the big deals with data at John Deere is that it belongs to the farmer.
Okay.
And the farmer's in full control. So they can go into their operations center account, and they determine who has access to it. John Deere doesn't aggregate that data. We don't sell that data. We are not in the data business. We are in the business of helping farmers collect the data to be able to make better decisions. But at the end of the day, the farmer decides who gets to see that.
Okay, and that's a big thing that we hear. I mean, you know, I was joking, obviously, but we hear that either, John. You're spying on me, you know what? I don't want you to know what my information is. I don't want you to know my soil information, my yield information. How do you address that?
Well, I think, you know, again, I will piggyback off what Dan said to an extent, that there are customers who don't want to share that data, and that's okay. We're good with that. But I think what we're seeing, and I'll use you said a 12,000 acre buddy for farms in Arkansas. What we're seeing is those who manage their data very closely and look to bring other experts to the table to help them make decisions. That's where the dealership can partner with customers to help them drive decisions. I mean, let's be honest. If you go out to a farm, Damien, there's some operations that have more horsepower than they need. Mm-hmm. So when we have the ability to look at engine load factor, which is basically how much of the engine horsepower we are using to complete a pass, and if we're only using 50% of that capacity, do we really need a 400 horsepower tractor? Or is there a time of year where we need to, you know, we might need that 400 horsepower tractor at a certain time, but it gives us the ability to come alongside our customers and help them make decisions. So.
Well, there's a degree of efficiency. And I guess what I'm going to throw out there, and since you're the farm guy as well as the dealer guy and John Deere guy, I don't like that my smartphone knows where I am. I don't like that my habits are being monitored. I don't like it. However, that phone that's got as much technology as the Apollo program also makes it so that I'm more efficient. I checked in for my flight last night at 11 o'clock on that smartphone. It makes my business more efficient, it makes me more money, and it makes my life easier. I have sacrificed, I guess I'm old enough to think, a certain degree of control or autonomy. And you're about there also. What do you say to the farmer that kind of, we know it, but you've got to do it, right?
Yeah, they have to be comfortable with it. And, you know, for me, our farming operation, there's different levels of sharing you can do. So I get to choose, does our agronomist see the info? Do the landlords see the info? And then how do we exchange that? And yeah, people are afraid of it up front, but we've found that people get more comfortable as they go. But there's got to be an ROI, there's got to be a benefit. And you know, at some point, most people realize that, hey, there's some big advantages to doing this.
Yeah, well, it makes you more efficient. But then he's talking about who to share it with. Is that like a swipe left, swipe right thing? you know? All right. Overwhelmed. That's one of the things. We're at the age where if you brought a 18-year-old up here, there's stuff that we still have to look at, and they just go boop, boop, boop. Okay, there's always that thing about age and adoption, age and adoption, age and adoption. What are you seeing? We talk a lot about the 59 and a half year old average age of the American farmer. You talked at the presentation you gave yesterday about adaptability. Mm-hmm. What are you seeing? What are you, from a corporate and from four states that you cover side, what are you seeing adoption and adaptability?
Honestly, we're seeing farmers of all ages adopt the technology. And that's what's pretty cool because, you know, farming's hard, right? It's hard work and it's hard on the body. And what we're seeing are some folks are able to stay engaged with it longer because of the technology. And so, you know, is there some age gaps in there? Yeah, stereotypically, yes. But honestly, like when we go out to farms, there's plenty of folks that are in the upper age brackets that are embracing this stuff and are in it every day and love using it for sure.
John and I went out to see a customer here a while back. And when we talked about the autonomous tractor, like he lit up because he felt like he had to retire in the next 5 years.
Maybe 2 years.
Yeah.
And it was like, I'm in it for another 10. Yeah. Like, let's go.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's empowering. At the same time, it's overwhelming. It is a big picture. You can see the benefit of it, but you also can see sort of the threats of it. And so that's where you are.
Yeah. What one thing, I don't know if we'd call it a trend yet, but as we're bringing things like See & Spray Ultimate to the market, we are seeing that those operations who are adopting that typically have a trusted partner, and that could be a son, nephew, yeah, grandchild, that gives them the confidence to make the decisions, but they are absolutely using data and information. And again, the owner operator is trusting someone. And that's pretty common that we're seeing, because the gut feel on making a substantial investment is it's not quite what it was a few years ago.
All right, so here's the thing about the technology, and then I want to move on to the money. You have this interesting situation where you've got this massive amount of technology. The machinery companies, they know it's not just about horsepower anymore. They know it's not just the John Deere 4020 can pull a four-bottom plow, five-bottom plow if you're light soils, you know, whatever. It's not that anymore. It's a different pitch now. Take me there. You're the sales guy. Take me there.
Well, I think the reality is that our customers who are going to continue to grow, and that doesn't mean just be big in scale. I think there's niche markets. I think that data is what's clearly separating those operations that are growing and working towards sustainability. And if you're not managing the data and information as part of your business, it's just we're seeing a separation. That doesn't mean you won't be successful and you can't continue to farm, but the ones that we're seeing grow and quite frankly have a clear succession plan, they are using data and information that's it's more valuable than the hard iron.
I would say too, from a developmental standpoint, for decades it's been bigger, faster, stronger. Mm-hmm. Let's make the tractor bigger, yep, higher horsepower, make the combine more efficient, all those things. And what we've seen is we're really moving away from that model and looking at the jobs that are in the outcomes of what farmers are looking for and trying to do the job better. And that always comes along with bringing the data into the conversation and being able to have information to be able to make better decisions going forward. So will we continue to make bigger tractors? Sure, of course, that's gonna continue to some degree. But equipment's gotten so large at this stage of the game that really now it's about how do we be more efficient with what we have? How do we make better decisions?
I want to talk about because I disagree with you about larger versus smaller, and we're going to get into that because sure, you and I did a little bit last night. We're going to talk about the size of the machine. We're going to talk about money, my favorite subject when it comes to everything, money, money, money. Because let's face it, this is the Business of Agriculture podcast, which means businesses make money. If they don't, they become not-for-profits or they go out of business. Before we get to the last subject, I want to remind you, if you like what you see and hear at the Business of Agriculture podcast, go check out what we're doing at Extreme Ag. There's no E on the front of it, extremeag.farm. Some of America's most forward-thinking farming operations. They've won yield contests. They're trialing new products, doing new practices, and we share it with you for free. Go to extremeag.farm and check out the Cutting the Curve podcast. Hundreds of videos that I've shot from places like, Commodity Classic, from all these guys farming operations to field days like Ag PhD up in Baltic, South Dakota. Go check out extremeag.farm and see information you can apply to your farming operation. If you're not a farmer, you need to know what's happening on these operations because it's some really cool stuff. All right, the money and the size. First off, let's talk about the money, then we're going to go back to size. You and me and you all know this stuff is tremendously expensive. You talked to me yesterday, Jeremy, about a $750,000 sprayer.
We sold our first million-dollar machines here recently.
Okay, a million-dollar machine. Listen, man, I'm going to use that. That sprayer, I'm going to use it 16 days a year, right? With a 21 days a year. And you want me to spend $750,000 on it? The co-op will come out for $7 an acre and spray my crops. Why do I need to spend $1 million, $750,000, $480,000? The money gets overwhelming. Talk to me. You're a farmer also.
It's all about the ROI. If it doesn't pay, we don't want to sell it to you. End of discussions. So we have to do a lot of work these days to help people walk through and figure out if that's the right decision to make. So you think about a $750,000 sprayer.
You're starting to sound like a salesman. I want you to put your farmer hat back on.
I'll put it on. So what do I spend on my corn herbicide or bean herbicide, right?
Okay, so your corn inputs per year, I'm just going to guess, all inputs, is that like $60 an acre?
Yeah, you're in the ballpark.
Okay.
So you start thinking about what if we could save 20%? What if we could save 50% on that? Mm-hmm. It racks up pretty quick. I don't care whether you're farming 1,000 acres or 15,000. You start saving $10 or $15 an acre, some of these, they're pretty simple ROIs at that point.
Okay, he's talking about something that we saw yesterday, and I know you're going to be all excited about it, but we're jumping the gun. This is supposed to come later, but that's all right. I know he wants to talk about it. What you're talking about, is, you're saying, because the listener's saying, well, just because I spent $750,000 on a sprayer doesn't mean I'm saving inputs. How the hell am I saving inputs when I buy a more expensive sprayer? Tell me why I'm doing that, John.
Well, so the how, right? How it works is it can determine what is a corn, bean, or cotton plant and what's a weed. So it's going to go through the field.
And this is the new technology called See and Spray.
See and Spray Ultimate, absolutely.
Something I predicted many years ago, I said, we're going to get to where we're not spraying all 43,560 square feet of a field because that's wasteful. We're going to get to where the technology's, and I still think it goes drone. But anyway, we'll get to that.
Well, already a thing.
Where
right?
we fly over a field and so your sprayer only sprays where it's needed for a herbicide.
Right. And you have the ability to broadcast at the same time. So you have a split tank that gives you the ability to broadcast as well as use the See and Spray Ultimate technology to target specific.
So if I'm putting out fungicide and a foliar treatment, I can still have that going broadcast. But as far as then in the other tank, I've got herbicide and it's on a separate spray nozzle and spray boom, and not a different boom, it's a different plumbing, mm-hmm. and then it sprays just the dandelions. It's still a hell of a lot of money. Tell me about the discussion. You sit down with me, and I'm a farm guy.
Absolutely, and the first thing that I want to understand is what's your current chemistry program? And understand, do you know what your costs are for your post passes? Mm-hmm. And that's where we get into the data and information. We have a calculator that we can walk through every step of your current operation, and then what does it look like if we can save 30, 40, and I'll tell you, we've got data that shows on a 150-acre field, we only sprayed 90 acres because of this technology. But with that being said, we want to sit down, customize it to you, because what we're finding in these conversations, Damien, everybody does it just a little bit different. So that's where it's really important to ask a lot of questions and learn about it. And this isn't a dig on farmers at all, but we also find that some farmers generalize what their inputs are when it comes to chemistry. And it's helped us come alongside shoulder to shoulder and make sure that do they really know where they're at.
So. But I will tell you, the first conversation is usually like, there is no bleeping way I'm buying something.
Yeah, right.
Just to be clear.
And I think it gets into the sales conversation, though. If you go into it and say, well, we're going to trade in your $100,000 4940 and we're going to sell you a $750,000 sprayer and I just hand you that quote, you're going to run me off the farm.
Yeah, right. It's too crazy.
Yeah, it's not new to sales, but it does really reinforce our process of understanding, asking questions before we get into where we're talking about what it costs.
Maybe it's always been this way, but when we talk about these dollar amounts, and I want to go to Dan, but I want to get it from you too first, it's maybe always been this way. And it's just a matter of the numbers get bigger, the acres get bigger, the equipment gets bigger, because that's really what we're talking about. There's some people that aren't customers, or they might be customers of some of your equipment, and they really should have the co-op come out and spray their crops, right?
Absolutely.
Because
Absolutely. They
can't justify that $750,000 machine.
And I don't think this is any different. I mean, we're going to continue to have customers that are, whether it's a hobby or part-time, that farm 150 to 300 acres, but the upper end is going to continue to grow. So we've got to figure out how to work with every customer along the way, and we will. We're not going to leave anyone behind. But I think we'll see models come out of this, Damien, that will allow us to do something from the dealership standpoint where we might own the asset and provide that or make that available to customers who maybe don't have the scale to spend $750,000, but they'll still have access to it. And we don't have that figured out, but that's...
All right, Dan Paschke, you and I talked about this last night. You just said a little bit ago, equipment's going to continue to get bigger. It can't. It doesn't fit down the road right now. The bridges going over little streams in my part of the world were built in the 1950s and 60s. They're not equipped for 30-ton farm machinery that's too wide. Not to mention, it compacts the soil. I know, sure. Oh, we got floater tires. Well, putting 30 tons over 6 square feet versus 4 square feet still compacts the soil. They're selling farm ground for $12,000 to $20,000 an acre. Doesn't seem like it'd be a smart move to compact it. I say farm machinery gets smaller, and it gets autonomous, and it may not even be owned by the farmer someday. We had a dialogue about that last night. It's a little bit way forward thinking.
Yeah.
Take me there.
I think it's a great question, and it's something we talk a lot about at John Deere. And I don't know that anybody's got that one figured out yet. There's a lot of folks talking about this concept of small swarm fleets, you know, that will come out and do smaller sprayers that can get on the land at any time, right after a rainstorm, when normal conditions wouldn't let a big machine on there. And maybe, five or six machines come out and do the job that one or two used to do.
Yep.
I think there's definitely a world where that could happen, for sure. We're kind of dabbling in both worlds. I think we're looking and exploring that opportunity. We recognize too that a lot of folks want, a big machine to get it done really quick. And mm-hmm. So I think the jury's out on that one for us, for sure. But we're certainly very open to that idea. I mean, nobody has that one figured out. I mean, what do you think?
What do I think? I think farmers, especially the ones that we all know, love bigger. I mean, we're not going to... Anyway, the point is we like to get excited about bigger. Bigger, bigger, bigger. That's all we've ever known, and that's all it's ever done. Eventually, it's too big for practicality, is my assertion. Do I have it all figured out? No, I do not. But I believe that we've gotten too big for the roads. We've gotten, we compact the soil. There's the tough part. How do you take 270 bushel corn off of a field? We didn't make 270 bushel corn 10, 20, certainly 50 years ago without one of these grain carts that holds as much as a semi or more. Well, there's a lot of weight there. So I understand the practical questions, but I also look at what I see coming. And so I defer to you. You're the farm guy from Kansas. What do you see?
Yeah, I'm pretty intrigued with the opportunity to have smaller units and fleets of them. And if you think about it this way, there's optimal acreages, right? Whether you're in Canada growing wheat and canola, and maybe it's 4,000, 5,000 acres per set of equipment, or you go to central Iowa, and it's 2,000 to 3,000 acres. But you start thinking about, now I have to go from 3 to 6 to optimize my operation. Are there opportunities in the future where taking on 500 or 1,000, and you just add another 8-row planter, add another small sprayer? So there's some opportunity out there.
John, you're the guy that's out here selling this stuff. Yeah. Am I right, or is Dan? I really want to know, am I right or is Dan? I would like you to say, yes, you're right.
You guys determine at what time.
We're not sure yet. I think nobody really
what
knows
what time frame, because I think that's the cool part, as Jeremy mentioned earlier. We are on a building block approach, right? So we are going to start with an 8RX and a tillage tool that will autonomously operate in a field. The question I have for the smaller drone type or fleet type model, how are you going to get multiple pieces on public roads and highways in a 40 acre field to an 80 acre field to a 100 acre field? I think that's probably the thing we have to think through as well.
And in some ways you think about it, it's more machines to manage, right? And so there's problems with I think that's why there's a lot of debate about it.
Smaller and autonomous fleets, there's more stuff to manage. Mm-hmm. There's more to do. But then I see that thing I got in yesterday, this four-wheel drive tractor, it's as big as my high school I went to, I swear to God. And it's got to fit down the road. And I mean, so I see it both ways, and I'm just being, okay, if it does go to smaller fleets, and you and I talked about this last night. This is way out there, but I like it. Who owns those fleets? Does a farmer own 7 sprayers that are more like drones, or is it not even practical or does it hit the Uber effect? Who owns this stuff?
I'll take that one. This will tell you a little bit where it's going. I mean, we started our own finance company 2 years ago because we know there are going to be opportunities. We have stores in Kansas, we have stores in Iowa. Silage choppers, forage choppers, they're used like 2 weeks out of the year, right?
Yep, right.
Well, there's opportunity, especially if they're $700,000 to $900,000. Can we move those from the panhandle of Texas to Kansas to Northwest Iowa?
And we've always done that with custom harvesters. That was the thing. I wanted to do that when I was 17 years old, and it dawned on me, you'd be sitting in a combine a lot. But that's always been a private company that gets 12 new combines every year and then works from the Panhandle, Texas, up into the provinces of Canada, and that's their business. But I see it not being a custom harvester. You see it now as being, you're the dealer, you own this stuff, and you fleet it around.
Yeah, if we're going to use our assets, I mean, as farmers, right, do I want a $900,000 machine sitting there for 52 weeks a year that I use?
It's a lot of capital tied up for something that you don't use much.
There's better ways to do it.
I agree with that. John, you're nodding your head. Do you have anything on that?
Well, I think today we're already working through some models like that where we give people the option to run it when they need it. We in turn buy that piece back and then resale it on the used market. So that's happening today. Typically customers of scale are looking at that model, but for customers, we'll also give them the ability to try new technology. So when ExactApply came out, which is the individual nozzle shutoff on sprayers, you could pair that with a 1600 gallon spray tank. We had a customer in Northeast Nebraska who had the 1600 gallon spray tank and the ExactApply nozzles on straight heading. They farmed north, south, east to west, big square fields. And the value that they saw was greater in the tank size because they had to fill less than what they saw in ExactApply because they were hitting the end rows at a 90 degree angle. Right. So in that sense, they got to try it. The next one they ordered had different options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they went with what worked for them, which is obviously what's going to always happen because things are different geographically. All right, Aimpoint Research company founder was on my podcast, say, 6 months ago. And he shared some information that right now there's about 175,000 farming operations of scale. And we're not in any way bashing on anybody. We're talking about of the 2 million farms in the United States of America, 105,000 of them produce 75% of all ag revenue. That's not being mean. It's just the reality. U.S. Agricultural census information, 58% of America's farms produce less than $10,000 worth of ag output. That's a real number. Trust me, I did it in my book. We're talking about, of the 2 million farms, really only a couple hundred thousand are probably customers. No, nothing wrong with somebody that comes and buys a John Deere mower. Nothing wrong with somebody that comes and buys a utility tractor. You sell to me a utility tractor every 15 years. I'm not going to keep you in business. This farm consolidation is going to go from 175,000 large-scale farmers, he says, this researcher, down to about 65,000 over the next decade. Do you see that happening, and what will that mean to us, to anybody?
Well, we're seeing growth and consolidation with our farmer customers. That's going to continue. Whether or not it's 175 to 60,000, I don't know. That. I don't have that data.
It's been happening for 100 years.
100 years, right? So it will continue, but what we're going to focus on as a dealership is we're not going to leave anybody behind because those large scale customers buy new typically, we still have to figure out how to work through their trades and serve the markets that are not of that scale. Yeah. So it's going to happen, but that doesn't mean that we just can't ignore operations of, I don't care if it's 500,000, 3,000 acres. We have to serve them all.
What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's...
John Deere doesn't care as long as they sell the equipment, right? As long as you sell the machinery.
We've got equipment for all sizes of landscapes, you know, from the smaller farms to even residential and property stuff up to the big farms. And, you know, I think what's interesting, though, is the needs of those larger scale farms are changing, right? I mean, they have a need for 24/7 support. They have a need for a lot of the things we've been talking about, helping them understand the data and the things that are available, how to optimize their operations. And I think that's what's interesting to me is that the way the dealers respond, the way the company responds to that, it's pretty important so that we can stay relevant in their operation.
I want to throw another, go ahead.
Yeah, there's one other thing. I think we have to be careful too of just saying that if they're a customer of scale and you can determine if that's a 10,000 plus acre farmer or what that is, that those are the only ones growing. I think we're seeing customers that may be well capitalized, have a succession plan and have the next generation that wants to grow. We're seeing some 2,500 to 3,000 acre customers that have very significant growth plans and a timeline that they want to get there. So I don't think it's just the upper end today. That's again why we're going to serve all aspects and get to know everyone of all scales.
And here's the thing, and we're not in any way being fatalistic about farm size. You've got to be this size to be viable because, you know what, there's a lot of niches. There's niches now that did not exist 5 to 10 years ago. Uber didn't exist 10 years ago. Whole Foods was just a little, you know, place that the hippies went to in Texas 30 years ago. There's all kinds of different things in the marketplace that are not what they were, you know, a few years ago. If things go autonomous and things go unowned, meaning you own this stuff, you bring me my fleet, doesn't that actually bode well for a smaller scale operator? Because now, hey, those guys that want to farm 10,000 acres and have all their capital, good. I want to farm 400 acres. I'm semi-retired. You know, maybe this might be Damian Mason's plan. I only want to be in Indiana from May 1st until Thanksgiving and then go to Arizona. And I want to own all this equipment. Don't I have a better opportunity if you own the stuff and my capital is not tied up in machinery? I own $500,000 worth of machinery instead of $5 million worth. Does the future actually get better for smaller scale operators in terms of the capital requirements not being as great?
There's opportunity there. It makes it very capital intensive on our end of it. But
I'd rather you be stressed about a payment than me.
I'm sure you do. Now, one of the things there is as people start looking at that, I mean, it gives them a little hope in agriculture, right? If I've got 700 acres of family ground and I thought I had to get out of this altogether, it opens up the opportunity for somebody to stay in it for another generation or two.
Your thoughts on this. Does it make it so that I can have my little 400-acre operation and the capital requirements are not as great, and you're the ones that are stressing about the payment, not me?
Yeah, and I don't know if it's 400 acres, but I do think
it's a number I have in my head, right, that I can handle, right, with my hobby operation between May and November, damn it, John.
I think we'll have options for producers. Now, is it going to be the low-cost option? No, but does it add convenience and managing an outcome where you don't have to be present? I think that's where we have to get the industry thinking about, is it's really about the outcome.
Yeah.
And if we can help manage that and it works financially on the front side, it goes back to what Jeremy and Dan have both said. I mean, it's about the ROI.
Speaking of ROI in business, I tell all my audiences that the farmer that wants to hang out in the shop and wrench on taking off disc blades, that's great. He's going to be doing that for somebody else as an employee 10 years from now or 5 years from now or even tomorrow. I think that the business side of agriculture has got to be at the forefront. I created this podcast 5.5 years ago to talk about business aspects of agriculture. It's not all about just, Old McDonald's farm and all that. Are you seeing, from all of you, the adoption of the business mindset versus just, I want to hide in my shop and be a farmer?
Absolutely. So it doesn't matter whether it's a three-generation farm, grandpa's still there, dad, the son. Somebody in that operation is paying attention to the business side of it.
And it's accounting, it's money, it's agronomics, it's a lot of stuff. But farmers love agronomics and yield more than they love balance sheets and income statements and talking to bankers, et cetera. Am I right, Dan?
I don't know. I'd maybe disagree with you a little bit there. I think.
Well, imagine that. How many times have we disagreed so far over the last 2 days?
Just a couple. I think if you look, so many farmers we sit down with, I'm amazed at the amount of information they have down to the per acre detail on what their costs are and what they can do to influence that and how they're thinking about the future and how they're hedging against that. It's amazing to me what the modern farm operations are doing and some of these families that have built these incredible operations. They're using a tremendous amount of information to really drive great decisions and be able to be sustainable.
Yeah. You know, he said on a per acre, right? I mean, we're down to measuring the square meter, and we're not very far away from managing each plant.
Per plant, sure.
Yeah, and you're talking about for output, for the return, for everything like that. Yeah. Let's talk about the age thing. 60-year-old farmer, the average age of the American farmer. Well, first off, it is a capital-intensive, low-margin business. It then favors age and the fact that you've got some hay in the barn to be able to do that. Does it matter? Do you see this? Do you see any of this mattering? I mean, it's been growing in age for a while. Looks like they're adopting the technology. I don't see any issues. Do you see any demographic issues out here?
I think I'll go back to what I said earlier. I mean, the customers who are embracing technology typically have someone in their operation that they trust to help them make those decisions and adopt the technologies. There are some that are going to ride off into the sunset too. They're going to take what they have, likely their land's paid for, and they'll exit gracefully. But I can't tell you that there's a clear defining customer that is or isn't adopting the technology.
Yeah, it's all about a mindset. I don't care whether you're 25 or 75. If people like learning, especially with the data we have today, and discovering things and finding, hey, there's a better way to do it, it's all about your mindset.
Demographics, I'll go back to demographics. We talked about the farm thing. Demographics, labor. Demographics being able to hire people. It's no small secret. I drive through the Bippus Indianas of the world where there used to be a store and a bank and a diner and, of course, a grain elevator. And now all that stuff is closed. With consolidation, with changes, and these are economic and they're also demographic. Are we going to have the labor we need? Are we going to have the people that are pursuing ag degrees? Do we have too many people pursuing the wrong sort of training? What do you look at when you see demographically challenges we'll see in the future?
I think one of the big things with the labor issue is that it's really going to drive innovation, right? Because there isn't as many people. And that's where, you know, autonomy is coming into play. That's where a lot of the automation.
Did you hear a speaker last night talk about that very issue?
I did.
And that's where maybe you kind of take it.
I did, but you know, we've kind of been at this for a little while. So one of the key drivers for us is it's harder and harder to find folks who have the background and the skills to be able to do some of those jobs. And so we're trying to automate a lot of those jobs and make it easier so that you can put people in with maybe less of a background, you know, they didn't necessarily grow up on the farm, but being able to, that labor issue, I think, whether we're talking farmers, whether we're talking dealers, I mean, it's just a challenge right now. You know, you drive around and you see help wanted signs in every window, right?
And we're allegedly heading into recession and we've got inflation through the roof and you still have issues getting skilled candidates for your positions?
Single largest problem we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you see demographically that we've not already covered with these two guys?
Well, I think when we look at how we train, recruit, and select people more specifically for sales.
Yep.
It's a different skill set than what it was 10 and 15 years ago.
Well, 10 and 15 years ago, and certainly 30 years ago when I was a kid, the guy came out there with a flatbed trailer and he had a tractor on there and said, this will probably work for you. And then you got out and drove around the barnyard and said, sure. It's not like that anymore.
Yeah. No, it's not. And maybe one thing, Jeremy, is the thing that with there being fewer people coming from rural America,
yep.
The thing that hasn't left our business is that when it's go time, the understanding of that urgency matters,
yep.
That's the hard part to replicate and teach if you bring people that are from outside of agriculture. So you probably have an answer. We'd love to hear how we can do that, but that's the piece we're trying to solve for right now.
Yeah, you mean the idea that it's as old as all ag people get and some of the people making hay? When the sun shines.
Yeah, or when dad told you to open the gate and you couldn't do it fast enough, or the cows were coming out and you had to run, right? I mean,
there's a thing about urgency, yeah. And it's seasonal urgency that a lot of people probably would not get. Like, you know, I'll get to that tomorrow. Like, no, a storm is coming. If that hay is not baled up out of the field, then we're going to have a problem. So.
Right. And you said make hay when the sun shines, right? Well, we have some autonomous tractors running today.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? They don't stop.
Yeah,
they run through the night. We have to figure out how to support 24 hours a day, 360.
Yeah, so your labor needs are going to end up being, you need a tech that can handle machines that we don't even right now have fully developed. That, you know, the machines are there, but we're going to get more advanced. You need someone that can fix that, and it might be anytime.
Yeah, we show up and fix forage choppers in the middle of the night because it has to run by 7 a.m.
Yeah.
And if it's not running, there's seven trucks and three packing tractors sitting still.
Talking about a lot of stuff here today. Let's talk about the future, because most of what we saw when we went to the field day yesterday, we saw a lot of equipment and we talked a lot about the future. What, besides just machinery, but from your perspective, tell me about the future from your perspective without making it about the technology of machines, because we kind of covered that a lot. What do you see in the future, anybody? Besides technology and machines, what are we going to see? Is there something that we haven't covered about the future?
So I think the ease and convenience of doing business. I mean, you've mentioned Uber. We've talked about Amazon.
Yep.
Why do people use that? Is it because it's cheap or is it because it's convenient?
Yeah, it's arguably both. Both. Convenience maybe more than the economics, I would say.
Absolutely. And so that's the part I think we have to solve for as dealerships is how do we make doing business more convenient and easier? I mean, the thought of someone coming into a dealership to make a purchase, that's less than 25% of our customers today. Most of our business is done out on the farm, or they have done all their homework online. And so to me, that's that ease of doing business using digital platforms. It's not rocket science. I mean, it's all already being done, but in ag, that's a huge opportunity.
All right, now we already talked about events, and we talked about, you know, we love going and kicking the tires at events. Well, we got less and less people that are actual buyers. Anybody that has been in business knows, spending your money and promotional time and spending your employees, putting them in front of non-customers is frankly wasteful. That's a change that I see coming in the future. He's talking about going to the farm. It used to be you had to go to the Farm Progress Show to see the big machinery. If you farm, first off, you can go online. You can pay attention to stuff like my podcast. You can go to the training facility. I mean, this is a changing way we do business to reach the customer.
Well, you think about what we were talking about and how personal every one of these discussions is to get down to what the actual needs are. That's hard to do in a large-scale environment, right? You need to have a one-on-one conversation, probably at your location, to be able to get some context of what your challenges are. And so we are seeing that sales process has changed a bunch. But you know, you mentioned one of the things that about the future and kind of what we're thinking about. Like, I think a lot about water and with the challenges that we're going to be faced with water going forward. I think that's a huge challenge for agriculture going forward.
I almost want to hug Dan Paschke right now. It's no joke. It's no secret that we've sort of been in disagreement over the last 2 days over different topics, which I actually like the banter, and so does he. He's one of those guys, you know, he likes the challenge. This might be the biggest agreement we have had, that nobody in ag, except for maybe a few people that are in the Western Plains that are impacted by the Ogallala Aquifer's reality, that it is about going away, water will be the biggest singular issue impacting agriculture, particularly west of the river in the United States of America over the next 10 years. I wholeheartedly agree. Then it brings up the question, does technology on the machinery side help? Clearly, it helps us conserve moisture. I mean, there's a lot of things there that can help with that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be all hands on deck to solve that problem, right? Everybody, every step in the process that's involved with agriculture is going to have to be engaged to help solve the water supply issue, I think.
He brought us a big one, Jeremy. Can you not do that when you look at the future without just talking about farm machinery? What do you see that's a big thing in the future that maybe we haven't covered?
Well, two things I'll share. So like Northeast Kansas, we don't have wells, right? We can't pump water in that area.
Most people think that it never should have been settled. Why? Only an idiot would have stopped the wagon train and even set roots up there. I mean,
my family left Illinois a few years ago.
Why?
God, they must have been soft in the head. I don't know. But you know, an example though on our operation, we're looking at putting in some ponds and catching the runoff, so we do a better job of getting rid of erosion that's going on, and then use that water in July.
Right.
Because 3 or 4 inches of rain in July, it's 70, 80 bushel of corn.
Yeah,
it's a pretty...
Yeah. So, but that's not necessarily new technology. Obviously, reservoiring moisture from the winter and spring to use for the dry summer, but we probably will get even more efficient at it in how we do it.
Yes.
We have to.
But one of the things you think about the future that I see, and this gets back to... We used to manage a whole farm. We went down to managing a field, down to a lot more of this is going to be, did I get an ROI when I pull out of the field? So one of the things that I see, and we're investing in people and capabilities and data, is when I pull out of that field with that sprayer that we saw yesterday, I want to know how much I saved. Mm-hmm. If I didn't save, I don't want to do it again. Or, you know, when I pull out of the field with a combine that I let do all the settings itself, I want to know, did it beat me, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot more of this is going to be on demand at the time of use, not at the end of the year or 5 years from now when I trade that machine. It will be when I pull out of the field or on that last terrace I did, what worked, what didn't.
This is my last question. We're going to go through this because, and I am saving a bomb for you. I know that it's not even on our script. That's why I'm pulling it out right now because we didn't use scripts here, by the way, at the Business of Agriculture. We use outlines, and I want to drop this last bomb because I love the fact that these guys are all smart and they give a different angle on stuff. John Carlo, you mentioned Amazon, Uber, all the things that are, let's face it, ubiquitous today, that just a decade ago, it's like, who? The place in the river in Brazil? What do you think? Uber? The things are changing pretty quickly. I will need a piece of machinery. Why do I need AgriVision? Why do I need Prairie Land Partners? And it's a fair question. I don't need a travel agent anymore. Of course, I still do because I've got crazy travel, but the average consumer does not.
How do you stay relevant? So in other words, I'm not being mean to you. I'm asking you, your challenge is it's the business of agriculture. And I think anybody that's in this industry right now, if I were in seed sales, if I were in crop insurance, if I were in ag retail, I would be asking these exact same questions. The challenge is staying relevant and profitable. What do you do?
Well, I think the first thing is what expertise do we need to offer your operation or anyone else's operation? Do you want to be somebody that's managing a fleet of tractors and servicing and supporting those? Or do you want to be on the business figuring out when to buy inputs and market your grain? So does the sales model shift? 100% it will. But I think our differentiation is going to be our ability to support a much more complex, technologically advanced piece of equipment, and then making sure that data is good to help the operation. Because I just don't see that happening on the farm.
It's expertise. And before we get to Jeremy, because he's got a lot to say, I will go to the Dan over here. The manufacturer of machinery will be there. Then there's the stuff in between. What do they do to stay relevant and profitable? And again, this could be extrapolated to a lot of layers in the industry of agriculture. Mm-hmm. We've been thinking that machinery was going to put man out of job. Man and woman, I'm sorry. Humans out of jobs. Since John Henry and the grinder that went through the mountain and all this kind of stuff. It's never happened. But there are businesses that don't really exist much anymore. You know, the phone booth manufacturer was a thriving business 50 years ago. What do they do to stay relevant and profitable?
Well, John Deere, most equipment manufacturers don't plan to go direct. I mean, it's so difficult, right? If you think about what we need these folks to do is to understand their local market and take the machines and the platforms and the things that we develop and then localize it and make it work and keep it working. We can't do that as a company. We aren't scaled up to do that. We don't have enough employees to take care of all the folks that are out there. So there is a relationship between John Deere and John Deere dealers that works really, really well together to be able to help make sure the equipment's working properly and make sure that the folks are buying the right stuff. I mean, Jeremy said a couple times today, listen, if the See & Spray technology doesn't pencil out on your farm, we don't want you to buy it. We have another solution for you. There's no way John Deere could figure that out for a customer, you know, from our facilities. That's just not what we do. We want to enable these folks to have the right products, the right services to be able to connect on a local level with their farmers. And we believe that, you know, they are the trusted advisor for the farmer. And we think that's really their role, is to help make sure that the equipment works right, help make sure they buy the right things, they're using the service, they're getting the data, they understand how it all works. I think that model, I foresee, I don't see that changing anytime soon.
Jeremy, you're the last one to go on this. You're the CEO of 32 different stores between two states. They have come together. Consolidation of dealerships has happened. It will probably continue, but that doesn't still fix the issue of relevance and profitability. You know, bigger. Hell, airlines keep consolidating. It doesn't make them any better. The only reason they're relevant is because I still got to get somewhere. You tell me what you think about when you look at the future to stay relevant and profitable as a business owner.
You know, we have no desire to be the biggest dealer. But last thing I ever think about, it is to be relevant, though. And how do we stay relevant? If you think about it, people don't buy a tractor to tractor, right? They buy a tractor to plant a crop, harvest a crop, those kind of things. But I think for us, it's we have to be there, involved. Data is worthless if it's just data.
Yep.
But if you use data to make decisions, get smarter,
yep,
figure out the economics of it, figure out, you know, you think about planting windows or with your dairy cows, right? There are windows of time that are pretty intense. Mm-hmm. Well, if we have 10 or 15 years of data that says these are the 4.5 days a year that you should plant your corn crop, year in, year out, mm-hmm, wet years, dry years, we have capabilities today to understand things we didn't have before, and there's a lot more coming. We saw some of them yesterday. Like, we have to play that conduit in the middle to help a farmer figure out what does make sense and what doesn't.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and this is the biggie, in the old days, I needed you to get a tractor. I can go online. I can go on my phone. Between now and me catching my plane here to leave Orlando, I could have a tractor bought and probably in transit to my farm. I don't need you to buy a tractor. I need you for everything, I think you said it, that the tractor offers.
Yes.
The application, 100%. Is that right?
Absolutely. And it's the outcome. I mean, that's what we're after, right, is whether it's getting the seed in the ground or getting the kernel off the cob, That's what we're trying to do.
To stay relevant and profitable, you sell the outcome. That's where we're going to leave it right there. His name is John Carlo, the director of sales for these two companies, AgriVision Equipment Group and Prairie Land Partners. They are in Iowa and Kansas. His name is Jeremy Ostrander. He is a farm guy from Kansas. Again, a part of the world, let's face it, that you kind of wish they hadn't stopped the wagon train at. They either just stayed where they were going or gone a little further, right? Anyway, joking aside about him and the K-State people. And then, of course, Dan Paschke, my sometimes rival but also friend with John Deere. He's a business manager overseeing four states for them. I am wrapping things up now, and I really appreciate these guys being here. I know this was a long episode, but it was a very informative episode, and I thank you for being here. Again, if you like what you're seeing here, go check out what I'm doing at extremeag.farm. It's really informative, and it's going to take you to new places on what's happening on some of the forward-thinking farms in America. Till next time, I'm Damian Mason, and this is the Business of Agriculture.
Well, that concludes another fantastic episode of The Business of Agriculture. This episode was brought to you by Pattern Ag. You know, everybody in agriculture understands the importance of soil health. We also keep an eye on our soil better than we ever did through advanced soil testing. But what if there was a company that provided predictive analytics? Not just checking out nutrients and all the elements that are in there, but also could tell you the degree of risk you face with disease and pest pressure. That's right, Pattern Ag can do that. They actually can tell you, hey, you're going to have a real issue here. You can preemptively, proactively treat for corn rootworm or cyst nematode or sudden death syndrome before the problem actually starts costing you yield. Go to pattern.ag, that's www.pattern.ag, to find the nearest rep that can help you start doing better for your soil.